So you've heard me say a bunch of times now that Lent as a season has a very intentional structure to it. It's been true for a long, long time in the church, and in recent decades we've adjusted a bit after the council to make it perhaps even more rich in its complexity and in its depth. So the Sundays drive the season. Sunday number one is always the temptation story, the testing of the Son of Man in the desert. Sunday number two is always in the gospel, the transfiguration story. So we've had that. So this Sunday with number three, and then the next four, and after that five, three, four, and five, they form really the kernel, the core, the heart of the season. And every year, those three Sundays form something of a rotating unit. They have themes to them, and this is where you kind of get to the hardcore stuff. And after that, it's Palm Sunday, and then it's Holy Week. So that's kind of the balance of the season as it stretches out ahead of us here as we race now toward its conclusion. So in these 3, 4, 5 cycles, Sunday 3, 4, 5, in year A, so there'll be next year, that's the baptism cycle. Images in the Gospels of light, of water, of rising from the dead, so very strong, powerful, famous Gospel stories. In year B, last year, that's what's called the Paschal Mystery Cycle. So Sundays 3, 4, 5 are all about the dying and the rising of Jesus and of us. So that's the theme for those Sundays. This year, year C, this is called the conversion cycle. All three of these Gospels, they fall under the umbrella of what it means to be converted, to have one's heart changed. So if one's going to figure out why these stories land like they do and we're supposed to pull out of them, one should know the church is driving at the point of conversion. That's why they are here. That's the whole idea. And what does conversion mean? It means, and Lent is supposed to tease this out, that I must look at my heart and you must look at your heart and recognize without any question or exception that there's something wrong with me and with you. The things in me that need to be changed, things that stand in the way of God's grace coming into my life, into our world, into our hearts. We are hard-hearted people and we are broken people, and there are no exceptions to this. Every single person on the planet has some flaw in them that must be mended by God. That's just the reality. By this point, you probably can point out all of mine to me, okay? And you'd be right, all right? And I could probably point yours out too, and I would be, frankly, right. This is the thing, okay? So conversion means I recognize this fact with honesty, and I say to God, I want to change. And there must be an urgency about this. I must recognize it's a very important task to have my heart changed and be full of God's grace. That's conversion. So Sundays 3, 4, and 5 are about that. Very important topic. If one's going to be saved, no. Of the three Sundays, this one, the next, and the next, I would say the next two are the more famous stories. This one is probably the most obscure, the most stark, and the most blunt and probably hard-hitting, and I will say difficult to understand. It's a tricky little gospel. But it is about conversion, right? So knowing our roadmap, knowing the umbrella, knowing what conversion is, then let's dive just for a second into the gospel story and figure out, well, what's going on here then and how does it apply to us now? That's the whole idea. So what's going on? Well, for one, as Luke lays out his narrative, we're in Luke here, Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem. He's getting closer and closer to his end and to his destiny. And on the way there, these news stories come up from the crowds around him, his followers. And these do not come up by accident, by the way. The first news story, and by the way, these aren't mentioned outside the Gospels. We have no other evidence of this, but we could take the Gospels at their own kind of historical face value. It's the story about Pontius Pilate killing Galileans, which is where Jesus is from. And so this is already a foreshadowing of what's coming in a couple of weeks when another famous Galilean, Jesus, will be put to death by Pontius Pilate. So this is hanging death in the air right off the bat in this story. The Lord's end is foreshadowed here. And we know that Pilate, historically, was a person who was not afraid to make a mess to get things done. He was not afraid of bloodshed, so this wouldn't be out of character for him. What are the news stories? Now, the first one, they say to Jesus, you know, they mingled blood with the sacrifices. Pilate mingled blood. So to rephrase that, what they're trying to say is, at some worship ceremony in Galilee, maybe Jewish, possibly Gentile, when they were offering sacrifice, the Pilate's men killed these people. It was a death at a worship service. That's very alarming, I think you would agree, especially in the context of one tonight, right? Imagine how awful that is. And it unsettled these people. So they ask Jesus about it. Well, why? And it's their way of raising a contemporary cultural point if you're a Jew in the first century. In the Jewish mind of the time period, if something bad happened to you, it was because you had done something wrong. There was some sort of a punishment. And even more than that, if it was especially serious, tragic, or even unexpected, you thought to yourself, well, they must have been really bad people for something like that to happen to them. And this is what's going on behind their questioning of Jesus. They think this is the deal. These people must have been seriously problematic folks. And beyond that, it was their way of, I think, putting some distance between themselves and that situation, as if to say, well, they must be really bad. We're still alive. Therefore, we're okay. That's what we're going to conclude here. Jesus dispels a lot of this. And his simple answer to the news reporting is, listen, people, you're just like they are. If you think that this happened to them because they're worse than you, you're mistaken. Frankly, you're all bad. That's really the point he's trying to make. What happened to them can happen to anybody. Death can come for anyone. And no one is escaping this earth alive. So therefore, what we must always understand is that if you don't convert, if you don't change, you're all going to wind up in the exact same spot. So don't hide behind distinctions. Don't seek some comfort in you being better off than them. He's trying to say, no, everyone faces the same fate. It just got them first before you. That's his answer. It's a bit unsettling, but that's the point. He's trying to call them to the conviction that they must do something about their bad situation, which is they are sinners. You and me too, we are sinners. That's the fact. So that's his first story. And then to underscore the point, he brings up his own story. He says, what about the ones in Jerusalem, where I'm going in a few weeks or whatever it is? He said, when the tower at Siloam fell on those 18 people, another news story, right? This is his Jesus Twitter feed. He's looking at his phone, right, talking about these things. In Jerusalem, Siloam was the pool where, in John's Gospel, the blind man has his eyes washed. And we know that along one edge of Siloam, there was this kind of wall for the edge of this temple mount and city. And on the wall, there were these overhanging ramparts. So what would happen is one of them fell and landed on a bunch of people, and it killed them. It's the same idea. He's trying to say, you know, yes, it's true. That morning when they woke up, they didn't know it was going to be their last day. They died like that. And it doesn't make them worse than you, he says. It can happen to anybody. Any day can be your last day. Any day can be your last day. So therefore, shape up. That's what he's trying to say. And don't retreat in the comfort of, oh, they must be worse than me. They got that bad thing. He said, no, 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 it's coming to you all. It's coming to you all. That's what's going on in these stories, okay? How does that apply to us? Well, you know, I think we do something similar in our modern world, and it goes kind of like this. We've gotten so good at kind of pushing back the boundaries of death and having warning systems and safety devices and all of our kind of technological medical means that we get so comfortable thinking we're just frankly not going to die, that we can escape all of this. And in the same kind of idea, think, well, I don't got to worry about my soul right now because I'm going to live forever, right? I mean, death is way over there. So we have a similar, I think, unfortunate mindset a lot of the time. We could say other news stories. Those people in the Ukraine, Jesus, are they worse than us that all this absolute disaster has fallen upon them? He's going to say, well, no. It can happen to you too. You're just like they are. Just got them first. You're next. That's how he would answer the question, like the crowds put it. The tower at Siloam, unexpected death, sad thing, right? The fact is, everybody here, if we think about it, knows somebody who woke up one morning not realizing it was going to be their last day, and they died like that. So the fact of the matter is, okay, everybody has to be prepared. That's the reality, that's the point. And this is a stark way to go about it. We don't like things like this in our current culture that pushes death so far to the margins, but in the gospel context, as one way to drive at converting hearts, he's trying to say, you know, fear this just a little bit, the Lord's trying to say. Or to rephrase it, you might say that the role of death, the role of mortality, among other things, is to keep us honest. So live your life like it's perhaps your last day. Go to confession, do works of penance, do works of charity. Change your hearts. Search yourself and see whatever is wrong. Hand it to Jesus and let him work on it. So all of that is the opener, okay, for these gospel scenes. It's about trying to move us to convert because we are fragile people and life is short. That's the deal. Then there's this whole fig tree business. What about that? Luke is so great for obscure stories. What's all that about? Well, okay, so to kind of make it as simple as I can, it's complicated. If the other ones are about the fact that death's role is to keep us honest and answer the question, why do I die, so I can face my judge and answer for my behavior, convert, the fig tree is about why am I alive? Why am I breathing right now at all? Why am I alive today? And the answer is, so you can change. That's why. The fig tree story is about buying more time. It's about God giving an extra chance. It's about the fact that no tree can produce fruit on its own that God is going to find worthy of salvation. It must be given to us. Salvation is a gift. It's not earned. So we can't bear enough fruit. We just can't. And so in this story, there's an extra year given to this tree because God is generous. He is kind. He's like, well, give it one more chance, one more day, one more shot, one more year, one more period of time. So he is generous. If one flips further into the New Testament to the letter of Peter, the question is asked, why hasn't Christ come back yet? Why hasn't the second coming happened yet? And the answer is because he's giving you more time to shape up. That's the reason. He's generous. So therefore, okay, why am I alive today? Because God has given me another chance to repent. That's the reason. So the church on Sunday number 3 here and Sunday 4 and Sunday 5, and the next 2 Sundays come out from a whole other direction, but the point is still the same, says to us, this is the time of the year of favor. This is the year of grace. Lent is the extra time window that you don't deserve, but you're given, which is the time to change, to realize one day my life will end. I'm not prepared to meet my maker, let's be honest, so don't waste this time. That's what this story is about. So do what you must do to get right with God. That's the whole idea, okay? Now, this is one angle. There is another angle this Sunday that might be used, if you could say, to get us to the converting of heart piece. And it goes kind of like this. It's from the first reading. Here in the first reading, we find Moses. What does he do? He encounters the living God. And it's worth unpacking a smidge just who this God is that Moses meet. It's a very mysterious and impressive figure. It's a bush that's burning without being burnt up, so he's mysterious, he's mighty, and it's this kind of deep, powerful, very other kind of entity. So Moses learns in a hurry that this God is way beyond him. This is a grand being, and Moses is small. This is a God that should inspire a fear in one's heart. So you don't mess with this God. This God says, I am, as if to say, I am being itself, the very author of all being, that's me, and you're small, Moses. So that comes through loud and clear, okay? God is the vast other, Moses is not. But there's something else, though, too. This is the God who is not only mighty and grand and beyond us, this is the God of very, very close, intimate friendship with his people. Because what's he say to Moses? He says, I know what my people are going through. I've heard them. I listen to them. I hear their cry. I understand. So I'm close to them. And when you tell them who I am, tell them I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As if to say, the one who has been with you all along. I've never left. I've been constant, constant, constant. Faithful, faithful, faithful. Close, close, close. I'm reliable, reliable, reliable. So a God who is mighty, a God who is tender. A God who is a judge, but he does so with mercy. It's a beautiful image. Our God is so amazing, no? So if I'm going to seek to have my heart changed, and we all must, that's the point, right? I'd be wise, and you would be too, to spend some time each day in front of the same God. To put ourselves in Moses' shoes in the story, in front of the burning bush that is the Lord Jesus Christ and his Father and the Holy Spirit, which is present here on the altar, here in the tabernacle, here in the word, here in our prayer, let myself meet this God who is mightier than me, who I can't push around, but who also knows all my struggles, all my challenges, all my fears, all my needs, and who tells me I have been with you all along, always, always, always. We're loved so much more than we deserve, you know. And when one encounters a God like that, often enough, it does melt the heart. It does make one want to change and be better, as God calls us to greatness, like he does Moses, over and over again. Consider those two different directions on the conversion theme. My life is short. I must accept that fact and prepare accordingly, one. Two, I must stand before God each day and meet the God who made me, who can take me out of this life, and who loves me so tenderly that he knows me intimately better than anybody else possibly can and assures me that he loves me so, so much. These things move our hearts, no? So as Lent rolls on, church says, this is the year of favor. Don't waste it. Drink these things in, be converted, let grace fill your hearts, and walk ever new in the path of salvation as the sons and daughters of God that he knows that we can all be.